I was surprised to read something last night about Venezuela. And a guy you may well know from Venezuela, Bloomberg Businessweek, has a story in its latest edition about upcoming elections in Venezuela and about the strategy of that country's socialist party. This is the party of the late Hugo Chavez, the unpredictable autocrat who used to lead that country. The United Socialist Party's strategy, at least according to Bloomberg Businessweek, is to dazzle the electorate with celebrity candidates, hoping that the glitz and the bright lights and the white teeth may distract voters from the country's unemployment and collapsing services. For three key elections, the United Socialist Party has recruited, one, a huge pop star down there, El Potro. Number two, the host of a Venezuelan reality TV show. And three, a wealthy ex-athlete. The athlete is former Detroit Tiger All-Star Maglio Ordóñez. Critics say the candidates hardly lead lives of socialistic austerity. El Potro's been married to two Miss Venezuelas. Do you get more bourgeois than that? The three are running for mayor positions in various suburbs of Caracas, Venezuela. The election is December 8th. Maglio Ordóñez, mayoral candidate in Venezuela. Well, our election 2013 coverage continues today with a look at a city charter amendment proposal to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana in Lansing. It's on the ballot 1 week from today. More than 6,000 people signed a petition to put the amendment on the ballot. Marijuana has been made legal in two states. And for the first time ever, a recent Gallup poll found that a majority of Americans, 58%, favor legalization. What would the passage of the Lansing Charter Amendment mean? And is the time right for Lansing to move away from enforcement of marijuana laws? Attorney Jeff Hank of the group Coalition for a Safer Lansing is behind the effort to decriminalize pot in Lansing. We welcome him back to Current State. Hi, Jeff.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings Jr. as well to get his views.
Third.
The third. Stuart Dunnings Jr., the third.
No, it's Stuart Dunnings the third.
The third to get his views. Thanks for joining us again, Stuart. Mm-hmm. We also reached out to the Lansing Police Department, but Police Chief Mike Yankowski was not available to join us. Let's start with the ballot language here, Jeff, and I'll quote. This is what voters will see 1 week from today in Lansing. Shall the charter of the city of Lansing, Michigan be amended such that nothing in the code of ordinances shall apply to the use, possession, or transfer of less than 1 ounce of marijuana on private property by a person who has attained the age of 21 years, unquote. There's been a lot of talk over what passage would actually mean in Lansing and some degree of confusion. Jeff, what's your intent with this language?
Well, our intent, Mark, is to have the Lansing police back off of enforcement of adult possession, use, or transfer of marijuana. And that's our goal here. We want the police to focus on real crimes, more serious crimes. You hear all the time about budgets being cut, police officers being laid off, concerns of people about public safety. And I think most people, as you said, with the Gallup poll earlier, are supportive of the idea that it's time to treat marijuana, or as I like to call it, cannabis, differently. So the goal here is to save police resources, have a more safe community by having police focus on more serious crimes, and make people feel like they have some of their freedom back by doing this. And overall, we hope that it improves community relations between police and the public, and that overall we have a better community, and that this leads the state and hopefully the federal government to move forward on cannabis reform in general.
Did you spend much time looking at possible unintended consequences of passage?
Well, there's always unintended consequences, and I'm sure that this ordinance, actually this charter amendment, will be interpreted by courts someday, or you'll have people rely on it. You know, we can't really deal with what's going to happen in the future, but our goal is, you know, pretty simple, and it's pretty straightforward language, and that's to have, you know, the police back off and not enforce, you know, minor possession, use, or transfer by adults on private property of marijuana.
Stuart Dunnings, I'd be interested in your response to that. This would apply to less than an ounce of marijuana on private property by a person who has attained at least the age of 21 years, just for the city of Lansing. What do you make of this proposal?
Well, I think as a practical matter, it's not going to have much effect as far as law enforcement goes. The police are not out looking for people who have an ounce or less of marijuana. Normally, when people are brought into the criminal justice system for having that small amount of marijuana, they've done something else. So it's sort of like an add-on. So somebody gets pulled over for something, so for a violation, and they've got marijuana, or they have a warrant for something else, and they've got marijuana. So for those small amounts of marijuana, I don't think it's going to have any effect practically. Also, this only goes to violations of the Lansing City Ordinance. It doesn't do anything about the state law. It doesn't do anything about federal law. So if the city of Lansing wants to tell their police officers, don't write ordinance tickets, you know, for this small amount of marijuana, there's nothing to prevent them, if the person's involved with another crime, with bringing it over to the prosecutor's office, a violation of state law, and saying, oh, you know, in addition, this person had X amount of marijuana, which they could then be charged under state law. And again, it's still a federal violation to use, possess any amount of marijuana. As far as unintended consequences, like you mentioned before, I think the probably the biggest effect would be psychologically, everybody thinking, well, you know, marijuana is legal. But the other one that we've seen as a result of the increase in medical marijuana use is drugged driving, people driving under the influence of marijuana. Unfortunately, I tried to break out the stats for the number of cases we've charged for that, but we can't, because the driving under the influence of alcohol and driving under the influence of controlled substances is the same statute, so it comes up just as the same statute when we run it through our computer system. So I can't break out the number of drug driving cases, but I can tell you it's on the rise.
Well, anything you'd care to add to that, Jeff Hank?
Absolutely. Our charter amendment doesn't deal with drug driving, as it's called. That would still be illegal under state law if you're doing that. We want to make that very clear. We don't encourage or want people to be driving when they're impaired. And I didn't bring any studies with me today, but there are some studies out there to show that people driving under, you know, moderate or minor use of marijuana are no more dangerous drivers than normal drivers. I mean, people who drive distracted by cell phones or lack of sleep or prescription drugs are also potentially dangerous drivers. So we don't equate necessarily the use of marijuana with dangerous driving. Could it be? Certainly, but just so could anything else be. So we want to make that clear that what we're doing doesn't apply to people driving under the influence. It doesn't apply to minors. That's the two biggest concerns we hear from people. Well, those kids will get it more. People will be driving high. Well, this doesn't allow people to do that, and doesn't allow kids to do that, and kids are already getting it right now. So our idea here is to sort of stimulate this discussion and talk about how can we go forward to create better policies here, and that starts by the city of Lansing backing off of, you know, minor use, possession, and transfer by adults.
Okay. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette has notified the governor that, in his opinion, the amendment is not consistent with Michigan's Home Rule Cities Act, and that even if this measure passes, marijuana will remain a controlled substance, as you've alluded to, Stuart Dunnings. It will remain a controlled substance under state and federal law. The governor agrees, and he does not approve of the amendment. Can we clarify what the Home Rule Cities Act actually says, either of you?
Oh, yeah, I can just briefly touch on that. The charter amendment has to go through the Home Rule Cities Act. That lays out the process for amending the charter. And, for example, in this case, we had to have 5% of Lansing voters sign a petition in order to amend the charter. The Home Rule Cities Act then has any proposed charter amendment anywhere in the state of Michigan that falls under that act go to the governor for approval. Now, the governor, this happened in Detroit and other places also, they essentially have to approve it, even, you know, to allow voters to vote on it, whether or not they agree with it or not. In this case, the state. So it goes to the state for review, and then that's what you're talking about, that Bill Schuette and right. Rick Snyder sent letters saying they don't approve it, but it still goes to the voters, even if they don't approve it or even if they say it's inconsistent. So it's going to be before the voters. Our final point is you brought up the Controlled Substance Act. Michigan and the federal government still treats marijuana as a Schedule 1 drug, which means it has no medicinal benefit. I think most people these days and voters of the state of Michigan have said marijuana does have a medicinal benefit. That's why we have a Medical Marijuana Act. So that classification, most people and we believe, needs to change, and we hope that this helps lead to that.
Mayor Virge Bernero has voiced support for the amendment. The Lansing State Journal reports that he calls the marijuana prohibition, quote, a complete failure. I assume it helps your cause to have the backing of the mayor. How has that played out, Jeff?
Well, we're very pleased. That was an unsolicited endorsement by Mayor Bernero. To hear politicians talking this way today, and at least half the city council candidates support either what we're doing directly, or I've even heard Brian Jeffries say he supports decriminalization. Just about all of them support doing something. So I think that's a sea change in attitudes. 10, 15 years ago, I think politicians would have been afraid to say that. And so we're pleased that Mayor Bernero's taken a leadership position on the issue and is out there hopefully stimulating the discussion.
Stuart Dunnings, can you clarify for us, please, if the county sheriff's deputy arrested somebody for marijuana in the city of Lansing, or the state police, state police, which statute would they likely invoke?
They would always use state law.
The county and the state always use.
Yeah, they'd always use state law.
And what are the odds of a county law enforcement a person or a state policeman stopping somebody for marijuana in the city of Lansing?
Probably not as great with the county. They tend not to come into Lansing. But, you know, oftentimes the boundaries are, you know, illusory sort of. If they're following somebody or chasing somebody and they start outside the city and they go into the city, the state troopers there are state troopers patrolling Lansing all the time now. The chances of being interdicted by a state trooper is probably there.
Is there a chance for selective enforcement here? For example, you alluded a few minutes ago, Stuart Dunnings, to people who are caught in possession of a small amount of marijuana, but frequently the charges involve some other thing.
They've done something else.
Okay. So for repeat offenders or something in conjunction with another crime, would you expect a harsher law to be imposed rather than the Lansing City marijuana ordinance if it passes?
Well, I guess if you're saying so, if the police come upon somebody acting suspiciously and they have a gun, an illegal gun on their person, and they also have some marijuana, there's nothing selective about it. I mean, they've been caught. They're going to be charged under state law for the weapon violation, and we'd have the marijuana also.
But could there ever be a situation, for example, where an African-American resident is charged with violating the state law and a white resident let go, citing the city ordinance?
That could always happen, Mark. I mean, if it did, obviously that would be a huge problem. But this theme is played out throughout the country and throughout the state anywhere these kind of laws have been passed. You have a federal government that's in conflict with state laws. You have local laws which are in conflict with state laws. What we would hope is that the local police will respect the will of the voters. And you have to understand that the overwhelming majority of marijuana arrests in the United States, I think it's 95% to 99%, are done by state or local law enforcement. It's quite often local law enforcement. So our goal here is to have – it's not just symbolic. It's to have a practical effect that if you are in the city of Lansing, which is a major population hub for Ingham County, you're most likely, if you're to have an interaction with the police over marijuana, it's probably going to be the Lansing police.
Mm-hmm.
So our hope is that we would eliminate a wide swath of those enforcement actions. And then it's totally up to the county officials or state police, or in the rare occasion that the federal government is involved, whether they want to enforce those laws. But this is sort of a piecemeal repeal of prohibition bit by bit if we can. I mean, this is a local initiative. These are local voters, and we're trying to, you know, create our own local law here. And this is sort of your traditional American democracy and these themes of the supremacy of different laws and how much local control do we have over our own lives and our own destinies, and mm-hmm. we're trying to do that here, and we hope that eventually it will have an effect at the higher levels of the state and federal government.
Stuart Dunnings, does it ever fall to you to determine, just clarify the process a little bit more, does it ever fall to you to determine which statute to invoke when a marijuana case comes to you? Does it ever fall to you to invoke the state law as opposed to a local ordinance if the Lansing law were passed?
We don't have anything to do with City of Lansing ordinance violations. I mean, let's take the crime of drunk driving, first offense. The City of Lansing has an ordinance which mirrors the state statute of drunk driving, first offense. Everybody that LPD stops, LPD Lansing Police Department stops within the City of Lansing for the crime of drunk driving first offense, they're charged under ordinance violation and sent to the city attorney if that's the only crime that's involved. So in this situation, I would assume that if LPD interdicts somebody that has less than an ounce of marijuana because the city ordinance says it's no longer a violation of the ordinance, of any ordinance of the city of Lansing, I would assume if that's the only thing going on, that nothing would happen.
Okay. We should point out that Lansing Police Chief Mike Yankowski told us through a spokesperson that the Lansing Police Department is doing its due diligence and is still researching the issue and would prefer not to speculate about things that have not happened and indeed may not happen. Jeff, what do we know statistically then about arrests, convictions in recent years? You've represented a number of people in this situation. What have you seen in general?
Well, you do see enforcement of marijuana possession and use. You do see it at the local, at the city level. You may see it in the city of Lansing. You'll see it in the city of East Lansing, just like Mr. Dunnings was talking about. Those are prosecuted under, a lot of times, local ordinances, depending on what city you're in. They can also be prosecuted under state law. I think to the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office credit, I don't typically see the Prosecutor's Office prosecuting people under state law for, you know, simple possession of marijuana. Usually it's probably pled down to something else. Part of the reason we're doing this, Mark, is that we think in some instances anyway, there's policing for profit. When you have a local ordinance that allows a local government to enforce a law and to make money off of it, they may be more inclined to do so. For example, the city of East Lansing would do this, where you'd get a possession of marijuana charge, and you wouldn't end up with a possession of marijuana charge on your record at the end of the day. You'd go in and you'd pay a littering ticket or something for $500. Now, a lot of people I know think littering is worse than possession of marijuana. You didn't even litter, but you don't want a criminal record, right? So you pay the littering ticket and you get a civil infraction and your criminal record never comes into being and disappears. So part of our goal here is to prevent the criminal record from ever happening in the first place. And people throw around the words decriminalization a lot. That's like what Grand Rapids did, where there's still a civil infraction fine. Our idea here is that we don't want a potential revenue source or there'd be any incentive for enforcement of a marijuana law. We feel that if it's a serious law, we should want to enforce it in the first place, and it should be something we should come down hard on, like with real crimes. And if it's not a serious law, then we shouldn't be bothering with it or enforcing it, and we shouldn't have an incentive to make any money off it in the first place. So that's why some local jurisdictions will enforce these laws, because at the end of the day, this money gets split up depending on who initiates the prosecution.
Where does that money go now? Where does the pot money that's retrieved in cases that go through your office, Stuart Dunnings, where does that go now?
Okay, if somebody is charged under state law and they are given fines, those fines would go to the court, and to the part of it, I think, goes to the county general fund. Part of it goes to the court. As he was saying, if somebody is charged under city ordinance, the fines go to the city. They don't go to the county. So, I mean, he's absolutely right about, you know, the financial incentive.
Okay. We want to thank both of you for joining us here today. 1 week from today, voters in the city of Lansing determine whether or not to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana on private property by people 21 years of age or older. Jeff Hank is an attorney for the group Coalition for a Safer Lansing. He backs the effort. And Ingham County Prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III. We appreciate your time, both of you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At the end of each month, Current State checks in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on fracking, ballast water, and pet coke. Back in July, Michigan residents watched as pet coke piled up along the Detroit River. Now, residents in Chicago are scrutinizing rising piles of the waste product. Wilson explained that pet coke is the byproduct of the tar sand petroleum being mined in Canada and throughout the northern tier of the United States.
When that gets refined, like at the Marathon refinery in Detroit and at the British Petroleum refinery on the Whiting, Indiana, which is just borders on Chicago, the byproduct of that is the petroleum coke, pet coke as it's being called. And it's got to be stored someplace before it goes someplace else. And right now it happens to be on the banks of the Detroit River, for example, the Calumet River, and those are in neighborhoods that where people live.
What is happening to the piles in Detroit?
The piles in Detroit have been moved. You know, there was a big outcry by the community there and even people in Canada. The wind was blowing the dust all around. There's particulate matter there, and it was causing problems. And after people trying to deny, well, gee, that's not a problem, but the outcry was such that they finally moved it. And actually, that's one of the mysteries. Where did it go? Everybody thinks it kind of went to Ohio. But that doesn't mean that more won't appear, because this is a growing issue.
It's not clear where it went?
It's not clear. People think it went to Ohio, but trying to trace the trail of this is not the easiest thing in the world. It's controversial.
And there's an environmental justice component here, too, correct, Gary?
Yes. So sadly, Mark, that's so often the case. These substances like the petcoke, so often stored adjacent to neighborhoods where, you know, people live, where kids play. And there's particulate matter floating in the air. And unfortunately, you know, these are people with less resources. They're less able to defend themselves against this type of action and negligence, if you will, by the people storing the petcoke.
Are these petcoke piles going to become a more common sight across the country?
Yes, they are. One of the activists in Chicago, Josh Mogerman from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and they track the petcoke and the whole tar sands issue quite heavily. The British Petroleum site and factory in Chicago is just now starting to gear up. They're not anywhere near full production, and they've already generated petcoke piles there are five stories high. So he reminded me that this is just the beginning of an issue that's going to have to be dealt with over the long term.
So no regulation, is there a permit process for storing petcoke?
There is a permit process. What happens is the Marathon Refinery in Detroit and the British Petroleum Refinery in Chicago, they have permits for their premises. And they comply with the permits. They're very adamant about that. But they don't have storage facilities, so it gets passed off to a third party for storage. That's when it starts to get murky. In Detroit, all the permits were secured after the fact. And, you know, the further away you get from the source, the harder it is to keep track of it. What the people on the south side of Chicago want is they want to be stored properly. They want it to be covered, because when the wind blows, it's in their windows.
Another issue people in the Great Lakes region are taking note of is ballast water and ballast water standards. A federal judge has tossed out the National Wildlife Federation's ballast water suit, which was requesting tougher standards than are being implemented. What's the origins of this lawsuit?
Well, the environmental groups, Mark, have been battling with the EPA and the Coast Guard for years, probably 10 to 12 years now, about ballast water standards. They want stricter standards for the ocean-going vessels that come into the Great Lakes. Shipping industry is opposed to them. What this relates to is bringing in invasive species. The Great Lakes are subject to about 180 invasive species that have been brought in over the years, most of them in ballast water. So the environmental groups, they want tougher standards. EPA is working towards tougher standards, but the shipping industry has prevailed so far. They want the international standards. There is an international set of standards for ballast water disposal, and the industry is happy to meet the international standards. And their position is, Great Lakes cities, you want to be an international port, then you should abide by the international standards. And for the most part, the EPA and the U.S. Coast Guard have agreed with them. National Wildlife Federation finally got tired of trying to work within the system and sued the EPA for violation of the Clean Water Act. But it was a technical administrative suit, and the federal judge just didn't see it, and he tossed the suit. The net of that is that the environmental groups are starting to run out of places to go. These regulations will be implemented pretty soon. And we'll just have to see what happens from here.
What would shippers have to do differently if the tougher standard were implemented?
That's a point of contention. The environmental groups say, first of all, the shippers can, it's a little bit like automobile emissions. Tougher emission standards are proposed, and the auto companies historically said, well, gee, we can't do that. We can't do that by that timeline. But when they're imposed, then the automobile companies usually did meet the timeline. Mm-hmm. It can be done. It's sort of the same thing with the ballast water standards. The companies want to hold off and hold out for these international standards, and they're loath to try to invest the money to do more.
And the impact on the Great Lakes, as you suggested here, has been profound in the past, the quagga mussel and others.
Exactly. And it costs money. One Canadian study said that various cities around the region and other entities spend about $200 million a year just dealing with the mitigation of invasive species. You can't get rid of them. All you can try to do is manage them.
Are environmental groups looking at options that they're being forced to look at that they haven't had to resort to before because of the situation?
Well, I think right now environmental groups are kind of stepping back and searching, what do we do next? I talked to a couple of environmental lawyers who are very close to the ballast water issue, and the significance of this suit being tossed is that environmental groups are sort of now out of options. These rules are going to be implemented, and there isn't much wiggle room from here on.
And Gary, what's been going on that's arguably overlooked or underreported?
Sure, Mark. Beneath the radar, I think, is this University of Michigan study that Governor Snyder commissioned sometime earlier this year about fracking. So what are the facts of fracking? What's the way forward with fracking? The University of Michigan and a group that they've assembled are looking at the whole issue of how much water is being taken, what pollutants are being used or chemicals are being used in the fracking process, and getting input from a number of different constituencies around the state. The reason why this is important is because it's not getting a lot of play, but fracking regulations are going to come out of this study, and it'll set the path for the future.
And why should the public take note of this?
Boy, if you live in an area that's going to be fracked and you have a well, your well could be exposed. It's very important. It's groundwater, which a colleague of mine says that groundwater in Michigan is really sort of the orphan. Everybody pays a lot of attention to the Great Lakes, but groundwater is just as important. And especially fracking exposes some really high-value streams to water depletion if it's not done right.
Gary Wilson is a Chicago-based Great Lakes commentator, and he joins us on the last Tuesday of every month for our Great Lakes Month in Review. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. One other environmental note we'll pass along. Scientists said on Monday that they have for the first time documented that an Asian carp species has successfully reproduced within the Great Lakes watershed. That's considered an ominous development in the struggle to shut the door on these hungry invaders that could threaten native fish. An analysis of four grass carp captured last year in Ohio's Sandusky River, which is a tributary of Lake Erie, found that they had spent their entire lives there and were not introduced through means such as stocking, according to researchers with the U.S. Geological Survey and Bowling Green State University. Dwayne Chapman, a USGS fisheries biologist, called it bad news. He said it would have been a lot easier to control these fish if they'd been limited in the number of places where they could spawn. This makes our job harder. It doesn't make it impossible, but it makes it harder. It's Current State on WKAR. Michigan's new right-to-work law triggered a dispute last week. The conservative Mackinac Center Legal Foundation filed a complaint with the state over what it claims is harassment by the Michigan Education Association toward a member. There are 8 complaints against the union, but the main one involves a kindergarten teacher from West Michigan. Miriam Chansky alleges interference and harassment after notifying the MEA of her intent to stop paying dues. Here's how the executive director of the Mackinac Center Legal Foundation, Patrick Wright, put it last Friday here on Current State.
What's happened now is the MEA is threatening these people with lawsuits and to ruin their credit if they don't give up the $1,000 a year.
Joining us today to share his organization's views on the complaint is Doug Pratt. Doug is the MEA's Director of Public Affairs. Hi, Doug. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mark.
We'll also point out that WKAR employees are represented by the Michigan Education Association. The last time you joined us on Current State was March 27th, just a few days prior to Right to Work taking effect in Michigan. Once the law took effect, what was the MEA's plan regarding members who would decide that they wanted to stop paying dues? What were they supposed to do?
Sure. It's the same as it's been since 1973 when MEA's resignation procedure was first adopted. Here's the thing. Right to Work changed nothing about being a union member. That's one of the myths out there. The Mackinac Center especially loves to promote that, oh, we have an end to forced unionism. No one was ever forced to join a union. What Right to Work did was made it illegal to charge people who chose not to join a union a fee, a fair share fee instead. Okay? So that's what Right to Work did. Joining or not joining a union is the same it's always been. And so we go to the rules that we've had for 30 plus years. And that is that in the month of August, members have an opportunity to resign for the coming year. Otherwise, their membership renews. That is listed on the MEA membership form. That's listed in the MEA bylaws. And in fact, the Mackinac Center sent out thousands of emails to MEA members who they got through FOIA requests at school districts around the state touting that news. So for them to sound surprised at this point that there was a rule and some people chose not to follow it is a little disingenuous.
Well, Mr. Wright claims that your bylaws at the MEA involving the August window are effectively taking precedence over the new state law, and that in a post-right-to-work world, he said it should be exactly the other way around. Did you ever consider expanding the time window to more than 1 month?
No, every process has a deadline. Ours is the month of August. You know, we have...
Why is that? What is
it's
it?
The start of the school year. I mean, typically speaking, school employees are on continuous employment and their employment renews at the start of a new school year. Now, mm-hmm. granted, that isn't the same for every employee like the ones here at WKAR who work year-round. But, you know, the start of the new school year is the start of our new fiscal year. That's what it's based off of. Here's what this is really about. Only about 1% of MEA members chose to opt out under Right to Work. And that shocks the Mackinac Center and the corporate special interests who back them. They thought this was a death knell. And the fact is, it's not. People are choosing to stay with the MEA because they want an organization that's there providing them a voice for public education in this state. And so suits like this, which by the way already got tried more than a decade ago, this exact same suit was brought with the Michigan Employment Relations Commission by the Mackinac Center in the late 90s, and they lost at Merck and in the courts.
Now, you've got 150,000 dues-paying members, correct?
That's our total membership. That includes active members and retirees.
And are you concerned that the publicity alone around the Mackinac Center suit may kindle more interest in not paying dues?
You know what? I think when it comes right down to it, it gets back to who we are as an organization. We deal with contracts. We enforce contracts. And when we have a membership form for an individual that says, I can opt out between August 1st and August 31st, that's a contract between us and that member. Now, if that member's employer violated their contract, that member would be coming to us wanting us to enforce it. We are simply holding up our end of the agreement and providing representation for a member, and that member, in return, has to hold up their end of that contract. This is about contract law. And for the Mackinac Center, a free market so-called think tank, to try to undermine contract law is amazing.
I think if Patrick Wright were here, he'd probably allege that it may not violate the letter of your bylaws, but it violates the spirit of your bylaws after Right to Work. See, that there should be greater flexibility.
Right to Work did one thing. it made it illegal to have those fair share clauses in contracts. It did not change fundamentally being a union member or not. It just simply didn't. If you read the law, there's nothing in there about resigning. There's nothing in there about union membership. It's all about the financial transaction and not being required to charge that fee. So this really is a stretch on their part.
I think in Miriam Chansky's case, what do you make of her case in particular? She apparently communicated to the union back in May that she wished to stop paying the dues. Is she still a dues-paying member, by the way? Do we know?
I don't know if she is currently paying dues or not, and that's not something we divulge publicly out of the privacy considerations of our members. Whether or not Ms. Chansky's a fan of ours at the moment or not, we're still not going to divulge her dues standing to the public. But what I can say is, yes, she communicated to the MEA. We communicated back to her that she needed to take a further step. And she even says she called the person who sent her the letter and chose not to leave a message. Now, I'm sorry. If we send a letter to somebody saying we need you to contact us, they call and say, oh, the person's not there. Well, I guess I'll call back. And then wait several more weeks to call back? There's nothing we can do about that.
There are apparently other unions that allow members to change their status on their work anniversaries. Here is how Patrick Wright referred to it last Friday on Current State.
Now, what's interesting about the MEAs is that they claim theirs is for administrative reasons, that they have to have it in August for budgeting and so forth. Some of the other public sector unions throughout the states just do it as a one-year anniversary.
How is it some unions are able to allow that option, apparently 12 months a year, but the MEA can't?
Again, it goes back to the typical school year for most of our members. The majority of our members work on a school year basis. So their anniversaries are at September. This is when their year starts. It's a logical time frame in which to put this. So, you know, again, this has been in the MEA bylaws, written in there from August 1st to August 31st since 1973. This isn't something new that we're throwing. So this is something that simply has been the way it's been, and it's been before Merck. It's been through this process that they're kicking off again, and we'll have to see what Merck says. We're going to have to go through that process. We believe in that process, but we also believe in contracts, and we are going to hold up our end of our contract with our members. And the vast majority, 99% of our members, literally, want to be members and want to be part of that contract.
How do you respond to people who say, hey, this is so much about money that it just raises all the red flags?
Well, of course, look, everything is about money. That's why they passed Right to Work in the first place, to try to starve out, you know, unions, particularly the MEA, because keep in mind that not only did this legislature and this governor pass Right to Work, they also passed a law that makes it illegal only for school employees to collect dues via payroll deduction.
Mm-hmm.
This is about money. Everything in politics is about money. This is about trying to starve out an organization that is standing up for the kids and the school employees and the public education of our state. We're one of the few remaining large advocates, you know, to keep public schools public. And if you have any question about the threats that are out there for public education, look no further than corporate-run cyber schools that are taking money out of our system, for-profit charter schools that are expanding and taking money out of public education, evaluation systems that are hurting public employees, and lest we forget, $1 billion a year cut to public school kids.
Do you expect the August window to stay in effect, though, or is there any kind of discussion at the MEA about a more flexible approach?
You know, there's discussion about it.
There is.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're looking at the numbers. I mean, this is a new world for us. We came into this not having any idea what to expect. We didn't know if we were going to have to deal with people constantly wanting to leave. We didn't know what we were going to walk into. Now that we have a better sense of the numbers, yeah, we're looking at processes. We're having conversations. But it doesn't change the fundamental nature of the contractual relationship between us and a member. They chose to become a member. they signed a form saying, here's what I'm going to do. I'm willing to pay you dues for the year in exchange for representation. And if I want to end that relationship, I do so in August. And that doesn't change.
We're talking with Doug Pratt, who's the Director of Public Affairs for the Michigan Education Association, about the complaint filed with the state over a few of its members that claimed it wanted to drop out of the union. Let's talk for a minute about your fee-payer members, because this is another thing. You claim this option has more or less existed for a long time, but does the MEA require fee-payers to continually opt out?
No.
It does not?
No. No. Here's the way to look at it. You are either a member or you're not a member. You either are a member and you choose to remain a member, or you're a member and you choose to resign your membership. Now, the question of fee payer status depends on your contract. If you have a contract that was in place prior to Right to Work and you have a fair share clause in there, then you're a fee payer. You resigned, you're not a member, your contract says you have to pay a fee, you're a fee payer. If you have a contract that is not in effect, doesn't have that valid fair share clause in it, you resign, you're a non-member. You're a non-member who pays nothing. It's the fundamental gateway question is, are you a member? Are you not a member? Mm-hmm. And then what your contract says from there depends on whether or not that fee is still in effect. But again, Right to Work made that fee, made that clause in any new contracts, made that illegal.
Have you learned any more as to when Merck will hear these latest complaints?
No.
Do you know anything about the timeline here?
No, this is still very early in the process. In fact, you know, we learned about these filings from the Mackinac Center's press release. Apparently, they filed the press release before they even filed the charges, which I think says something about the intentions here. Mm. It's still very early in the process.
The political complexion of Merck changes, I am led to believe, over time.
Yes.
How has Merck changed? Does the political complexion of Merck in the Snyder administration, in the current atmosphere that we're in, does that concern you in a way that it did not concern you 9 years ago?
Well,
nine years ago,
we were several years into the administration of another governor who historically wasn't a big fan. Governor Engler and the MEA weren't always singing Kumbaya. So the fact that the Merck panel that decided this over a decade ago probably was made up of three Engler appointees. I don't know that for sure, but 6 years into a governor's term, chances are he made three appointments to Merck. I don't know that it's different. The fact is, this is about a fundamental principle of American law, and that's a contract, a signed agreement between two parties. And for the Mackinac Center to be, you know, calling that into question, all of a sudden a free market think tank is just advocating for anarchy.
Doug Pratt is the Michigan Education Association's Director of Public Affairs. Thanks for joining us, Doug.
Anytime, Mark.
And now, to help us get in the mood for Old Man Winter, we have another public poetry announcement from current state contributor David Clausen.
Smoke in Our Hair by Ophelia Zepeda. The scent of burning wood holds the strongest memory. Mesquite, cedar, pinon, juniper are all distinct. Mesquite is dry desert air in mild winter. Cedar and pinon are colder places. Winter air in our hair is pulled away and scent of smoke settles in its place. We walk around the rest of the day with the aroma resting on our shoulders. The sweet smell holds the strongest memory. We stand around the fire. The sound of the crackle of wood and spark is ephemeral. Smoke, like memories, permeates our hair, our clothing, our layers of skin. The smoke travels deep to the seat of memory. We walk away from the fire. No matter how far we walk, we carry this scent with us. New York City, France, Germany, we catch the scent of burning wood. We're brought home. Smoke in Our Hair by Ophelia Zepeda.
its current state on WKAR. The local food movement is a growing economic and cultural force here in Michigan. We've had a number of conversations on this program about efforts to build sustainable regional food systems, which go beyond farmers markets and food hubs. Today, some local private businesses are joining MSU and state officials to announce the next step for Mid-Michigan, the creation of a food innovation district. Current State's Kevin Lavery has the story.
It's an often quoted fact that Michigan has one of the most diverse agricultural systems in the nation. From cherries to cucumbers, more than 200 commodities are grown here, ranking Michigan second only to California in terms of crop production. A system that large requires a lot of coordination from the plow to the plate. And while the state's ag industry is already a high performer, to the tune of more than $90 billion a year, officials in Mid-Michigan say there's room to improve. That's why they believe the time is right for the region to create its own integrated food network. It's known in the industry as a food innovation or food business district. Randy Bell is an extension educator for community food systems with the Michigan State University Extension Office in Ingham County.
A food business district can have folks who are related to distribution, light manufacturing, processing, transportation. Any number of different sectors that are involved in a food system conceivably could locate in a food business district.
A food business district in Mid-Michigan could particularly benefit growth stage companies. These are ag businesses employing up to 50 people and which generate up to $20 million in sales each year. Bell says these companies have the potential to either move into new markets or expand the ones they already have.
And there's more than 600 of those businesses that were counted in the study. In theory, if they had the right technical assistance and if they had the proper location, they conceivably could grow their business. And there is a building that the university owns in the area that we're defining as the Food Innovation District. And we think the market's there to help those companies to grow.
The building Bell is referring to is just off Jolly Road in Okemos. It's near a vacant tract of land parallel to Interstate 96, a primary transportation corridor. It's also close to a satellite facility owned by Traverse City-based Cherry Capital Foods and Earthy Delights. It's a food storage and distribution company, the kind local stakeholders say the region needs more of. When you consider that a food innovation district is founded on the notion of a geographic cluster of businesses, it's not hard to understand why the lead corporate sponsor of this agricultural enterprise is a real estate firm. Brent Forsberg is president of T.A. Forsberg in Okemos. He says the whole idea is to take established local businesses and those that are growing and bring them together to help build the entire industry.
Lansing has done this for years. We look at what's happened with the biotech industry here, and now we have the Port of Lansing up at the airport and the businesses that are growing there. Again, it's the same concept. This is just in food.
Forsberg says Mid-Michigan lacks large-scale food warehousing and processing centers that can create, ship, and sell value-added products in Michigan.
And in talking with one farmer, when it hit me the most was their products, their fresh fruits, shipped from Michigan all the way down to near Cincinnati to be processed into the jams and jellies that end up on the shelves at our local grocers.
Forsberg says not having to outsource that step out of state could reap significant financial gain. A separate study by MSU's Land Policy Institute indicates that even a 5% increase in regional ag sales could inject $22 million into the Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton County area economy. Supporters say a food innovation district would also help small incubators that help fledgling startups find their niche. Places like Incubake, a commercial kitchen in Holt.
Hey there, how are you?
Not bad, how are you?
Pretty good. Are you here for your order?
Marcy Bishop Cates is the owner. She prides her business on being a one-stop shop for culinary entrepreneurs.
When they come in with an idea, we can work with them through that packaging phase, connect them to local resources, help them get their licenses, and help them get out there.
In her 2.5 years in operation, Cates estimates she's helped more than 60 mom-and-pop shops get off the ground. Glory Bee Sweet Treats is one of them. Owner Diane Allerding is a one-woman baked goods retailer. She expertly cracks egg after egg into giant metal bowls to make apple cinnamon bread.
I couldn't do what I do by law or
in my kitchen at home at the level of I'm doing it here. It's awesome.
Auerning looks forward to the possibilities that a membership in a food innovation district may bring. She values the cooperative spirit.
I don't want to be the big box company. I need to know that the quality's there, that the passion that I have for this is shared by others. And I think that only works to the maximum if you have those kinds of diversity of places that you can move into.
As some of my clients grow and they're ready to move on to that next step, I hope that there's a place in the new innovation district for them to grow into.
Again, Incubake owner Marcy Bishop Cates.
I think one of the most important things that we need to do in this area is not duplicate efforts. We all need to work together so that everything fits in a nice and tidy way.
Michigan State University is poised to lead the way. The university is studying the idea of a food accelerator in the Innovation District near Interstate 96. That could be a facility similar to Incubake, but expanded to the nth degree. It's hoped an accelerator could be an anchor for the district that could help companies grow and sustain their food product lines. Randy Bell with MSU Extension says that's the costly part of the plan.
The proposed accelerator actually is the only part of this whole story that we're telling that I think will require some public money. The rest of the district and what's happening in there is pure capitalism.
There's no set timeline for MSU to decide whether to build a food accelerator. Bell says if it is approved, the project would be estimated at around $5 million. But private companies who are warming up to the cooperative say even without a large university-run facility, the Food Innovation District remains a plan whose time has come. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we continue our 2013 election coverage with a look at the race for mayor in Lansing. Current Mayor Virge Bernero joins us. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features the Lakewood Area Choral Society. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State here on WKAR.